This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
Welcome to Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson here at WDET in Detroit. Michigan's presidential primary produced a lot of news on the Democratic side this week. More than 100,000 uncommitted votes, or about 13% of the total. Many inspired to protest President Joe Biden's position on the Israeli war in Gaza, which has killed tens of thousands of civilians. Here at Created Equal, the results have sparked interest for us from a number of perspectives. For starters, this is a small demographic group. Arab Americans make up about 2-3% of registered voters here in Michigan. And here they are using the ballot collectively to exert pressure on an elected official to be responsive to their concerns. From a strategic standpoint, that is a key part of our small D democratic exercise. And here it was executed to a really high degree of success. And of course, beyond that, there is the moral dimension of what the uncommitted campaign is trying to achieve. How does this message sent to the president of the United States in a key state where just a few votes could make the difference in November, how does that affect what's happening to Palestinians in Gaza? What are the goals here? And are they more reachable because of this protest vote? Coming up, we're going to be joined by Abbas Alawiya. He is the spokesperson for the Listen to Michigan campaign, the group behind the idea to cast uncommitted votes in the Democratic primary. We'll also be joined by Abed Humood, who is the founder of the Arab American Political Action Committee. We're also going to take your calls today. Give us a sense. Are you one of the people who voted uncommitted on Tuesday? Are you a Democrat? Are you not sure that you can cast your ballot for President Joe Biden for re-election in November? But before we get to all of that, Debbie Dingell joined us earlier in the week to talk about the importance of Michigan's early primary state status. Of course, we voted earlier this year than we have in a really long time so that our votes would matter a little more in the process. And we're already seeing, of course, how the national spotlight can magnify the issues that Michiganders want addressed by their candidate. Debbie is back with us today to talk about the importance of Tuesday's result and what it means as we get deeper into the campaigns. Debbie Dingell, welcome back to Created Equal.
It is always good to start a day with you, Stephen.
Yes, thank you. Great to start the day with you as well. So it has been a few days now since the presidential primaries here in Michigan, and we've had a little time to think about what happened. The strong uncommitted vote in the Democratic primary is what made news. Give me your thumbnail of what happened, why, and what it means.
So it was the outcome on Tuesday was really exactly what I predicted. We always have an uncommitted vote in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
We had a little under 15%. Two congressional districts exceeded 15%, which matters because that means that there will be two uncommitted delegates in the Michigan delegation.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the primary itself helped shine a light on the pain that many are feeling, and quite frankly, beyond the Arab American Muslim community, that we have others as they're watching the situation play out in Gaza and in the Mideast. And quite frankly, people recognize that what Hamas did was horrific and a terrorist act, but the innocent killing of civilians is, for a while in the Arab American and Muslim community, is very personal, with many having family members that have died and are still there. I think the nation saw that this is an issue that's also bothering a lot of people. But the other thing is, Joe Biden got more than 80% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump got far fewer, but got less percentage, and nobody talks about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing I'm going to say quite simply is Michigan's a purple state. It's a competitive state, and we're going to be competitive until Election Day.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to talk about what this means in a couple of different contexts. The first is in the context of the president's campaign for re-election. This was a message crafted specifically for him about a specific policy. How does he fix what evidently is broken between him and his presidency and the constituency here in Michigan that is saying your policy with regard to Israel and Gaza is wrong? What are his options look like?
So I think what they called the campaign, there, you know, there were multiple campaigns within that umbrella, as you and I know. And I don't want, you know, some people are just discounting it. Well, they didn't get 20%. They didn't get, look, people are hurting, mm-hmm. and the president needs to hurt it. And as you and I know, because we had many an intense discussion in 2015 and 2016, mm-hmm. Donald Trump did win Michigan, and he really won it by just over 10,000 votes.
Razor so thin, right.
Razor thin, and every vote does matter. But there's more, by the way. I'm going to talk about this community right now, but there's more than that community that is competitive in Michigan
sure.
as well. I think that the campaign itself that was effective was called Listen to Michigan, and they wanted to be listened to. And I think the president has been listening. He has heard them. I think he thought he was communicating better than he was. He has sent his team out. Many of the leaders in that community who went to meetings have established relationships. He's working towards a temporary ceasefire. I am prayerful that it does happen by Monday. We'll see. And I've called for a ceasefire. We need to stop seeing today or last night, we've exceeded 30,000 civilian deaths mm-hmm. in Gaza. Mm-hmm. That's horrific and unacceptable. And my prayer is that the temporary ceasefire leads to the permanent ceasefire, the release of hostages, and that when that ceasefire occurs, then people can really talk to each other and we move towards a permanent two-state solution in the Mideast.
So if he can achieve that ceasefire, is that enough? Is there more that he has to do in order to get this community in particular to feel better about him in the White House?
So I want to say this to you, Stephen. This has been hundreds of years war, and it's not going to get solved overnight, mm-hmm. but he needs to show people he's working towards peace, a lasting peace, a two-state solution,
yeah.
Many of us have seen these false starts before, have seen hopes. Gaza has been destroyed. It's not going to get solved overnight, but I think that at the right time, he needs to meet with leaders in the community. I think he needs to talk about it. And when people are not raw, which they are right now, we need to remind them of all the horrific things. And I went in and reminded myself of all the horrific things that Donald Trump has said about Arab American and Muslims. And at the right time, we've got to remind people of that as well.
So you feel like the choice that this community has to make really is not between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, because Donald Trump has already not just said horrible things about what he would do if he were president to immigrants from Arab or Muslim countries. But I mean, we've seen what he wanted to do when he was president. But does that still put the pressure on the president to do something to get them to vote for him? I mean, again, Michigan was lost by a razor-thin margin in 2016. That could happen again if they don't show up in November.
This is what I want to say to you, Stephen. When sometimes you don't do things for political reasons. Mm-hmm. You do things because they're morally the right thing to do. And we need, if without the United States present and working so that there is permanent peace in the Mideast, which is something, as I say, people have worked decades and centuries for. It's never going to happen. And I've heard some very wise people say that in the last few years. Netanyahu has said he doesn't want a two-state solution. This country has to fight back, work with other countries in the Mideast, and be very clear that Palestine has a right to its own state. We want to, and you saw the resignation of some leaders in Gaza to pave the way for that going forward. Mm-hmm. Israel's got a right to exist too. That's why we need this two-state solution. I think many people never even understood what a two-state solution was. They'd hear everybody talk about it, but the horrificness of this particular, crisis, horrific tragedy, I think has shown many people what that is. And I think the president needs to continue to work towards getting a ceasefire, a two-state solution. And I keep saying to people, people should feel like they have to make choices. I think we need to fight hate wherever we see it. We don't understand that anti-Semitism and Islamophobia are both rising and that people of both communities are scared to death. I have been in rooms where they're all sobbing and they're crying. Hmm. And I say to people, a Jewish baby and a Palestinian baby are both babies. They're innocent children. And why shouldn't they all be allowed to be born and brought up in peace?
Yeah. So the flip side, of course, of the pressure that's coming to the president from the Arab American community is, of course, Jewish Americans believe about this. That's another really important constituency politically in the Democratic Party. Does he risk being caught between the two of them if he moves too far or too fast in the direction that this uncommitted vote in Michigan wants him to? Like, how far can he go?
This is why I'm trying to say to you, I don't think you can be driven by the politics of what you're trying to put it into. I think this has to be driven by, how do you find peace in the Middle East? Mm-hmm. How do you do what's right? Mm-hmm. And both, what Hamas did was a terrorist act. And I'm telling you, people are feeling anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. They're all people. Why? We have to stand up to hate. And I think the president's got to continue to move and push for the ceasefire and the two-state solution, working with other countries in the Mideast. Hmm. And that's the right thing to do,
yeah.
Period.
Yeah. So I want to talk about this in the context of the work that you and other leaders inside the party can and probably will be asked to do to help fix this here in Michigan. You were a resident of Dearborn for an awfully long time. Of course, you know that community really well. You know this issue very well. You're also a leader in the Democratic Party, not just as a member of Congress, but for a long time in the party itself. So what will be asked of you? What will your role look like as we get deeper into the campaign and closer to the election?
Look, I'm who I always am. I care deeply. I have many friends in all these communities. I talk to them. I listen to them. I get yelled at a lot. I get protested. You know, these protests, everybody's got the right to make themselves heard. I've had some pretty horrific moments with some things that people have said, and I meet with everybody. I talk to everybody, and I think that that's very important. But what I have been trying to do is to communicate to people so that they understand what the people of Gaza, what the Arab American Muslim community is feeling, mm-hmm. how many have families there. And yet when I'm with that community, I also talk about, you know, what the hostages' families have gone through. I have been badgered and bullied and threatened because I oppose sexual violence against anyone. Mm-hmm. That what Hamas did, raping women as a as a tool of war was not okay. People have demanded I retract it and called it lies. It's not. But there's also been horrific incidents of sexual violence against Palestinians and other places in the world, and I'm equally condemn that. That's what I've spent my, you've known me. Violence sure. against women is one of the things that I am the most strongest and passionate about. So there's a lot of intensity. My job is to help people understand right now. And then to make sure we're doing what we need to do before Election Day, and there is work to be done.
And when you are sending that message, particularly from Michigan and these communities to the White House, for instance, trying to get them to understand how powerfully these feelings are, how horrific the things that people and their families are experiencing are, what kind of response are you getting? Is the Biden campaign, is the White House listening?
I've had very direct conversations with the president that are clearly personal, private conversations.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have seen a change in tone, and see them very directly send some of the most senior members of this cabinet and this administration out to talk to leaders in this community. I think those leaders have established relationships, so I'm not the go-between, so that they're talking to the mayor of Dearborn directly, to Rashida, to many of the other leaders, and I think that's what has to happen, and I think it is happening.
Okay, Debbie Dingell, a congresswoman from right here in the state of Michigan. Always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming by on Created Equal.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Abbas Alawiya of Listen to Michigan and Abed Hamoud of the Arab American Political Action Committee. We're going to talk a lot more about the uncommitted vote and why so many people came out to vote against President Biden on Tuesday here in Michigan. We also want to hear from you today. Did you vote uncommitted? Did you vote for President Biden? Call and let us know why and what your thinking is as we get deeper into a presidential campaign year and as we get closer to November. The number here is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and at WDET. Be part of the conversation that way. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you're with us. We're talking about the rather stunning result of Tuesday's primary election here in Michigan, a presidential primary. On the Democratic side, more than 100,000 people voted for uncommitted, in part to send a message to President Biden about the current policy, U.S. policy toward the Israeli war in Gaza. We want to talk now with some folks who were from that community, from the Arab American community, and who have been thinking about how to put pressure on President Biden to change our position on the war and on other issues in that region. So we've got Abbas Alawiya with us. He is the spokesperson for the Listen to Michigan campaign. He's also a former chief of staff for Cori Bush, who's a congresswoman from Missouri, and he was the legislative director for Rashida Tlaib here in Michigan. Abbas, welcome to Created Equal.
Thanks so much for having me on, Stephen.
Also with us is Abed Hamoud. He is the founder of the Arab American Political Action Committee. Abed, welcome to Created Equal.
Thank you for having me. Good morning to you and to your listeners.
So, Abbas, I want to start with the campaign that you put together. It may seem obvious, I guess, but I wanted you to talk just a little about why Arab Americans are so motivated by this issue. Talk about how emotional in many ways what's going on is for your community.
Thank you so much, Stephen. So I come from the Listen to Michigan campaign. It's a campaign led by a few different folks, notably two Palestinian American women, Layla Al-Abid and Lexi Zaydan, who have done incredible work. But what's interesting about our campaign is that this campaign comes out of the historic levels of anti-war organizing that we've been seeing since October, that yes, is led by Palestinians and Arab Americans, but also very importantly by Jewish Americans and Black Americans and young voters and voters of conscience who are coming together and saying that there's got to be a different way, that using our tax dollars to kill over 13,000 children, over 30,000 innocents is not sustainable, precisely because here in Michigan, so many of us in the Arab American community have that lived experience of surviving U.S.-funded wars, U.S.-funded bombs, and the people we know and love and are in community with see the pain that we're going through and are saying, hey, this is a top issue for us, President Biden. You need to do something different. And so out of that anti-war organizing, we came together as Listen to Michigan around a strategy that says that if President Biden wants to count on our support, we have two major priorities. One, you got to come out publicly and call for a permanent, lasting ceasefire. And two, you got to stop funding the killing. I haven't slept much, Stephen. You might have noticed that.
But been a little busy the last few days, right? But I'll give you a break.
But on Tuesday, we got over 101,000 people to come together and lean into our power and say we are using our vote to send a very strong message to President Biden. We hope he hears us.
Yeah. So I want to go back to something you just said and have you talk just a little more about it. You talked about the history of having survived U.S.-led or funded wars and the prevalence of that experience among people in your community. I'm not sure a lot of people know about that experience or understand that truth. Talk about what specifically you're referencing there.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an important question, Stephen. It's such an important part of us here in southeastern Michigan, Michigan as a whole, really being in community with one another and understanding our traumas. Each of our communities has experienced militarized violence differently. Many people here in southeastern Michigan, many in the Black community have experienced police brutality here locally. For what that looks like for so many of us in the Arab American community, I can speak to my own experience. I was a child in South Lebanon in 2006 when it was U.S.-funded Israeli bombs that were dropping that could have killed me. They could have killed me. I could have been one of the stories that we do not know, one of the more than 13,000 stories of children right now in Gaza, we do not know. And so what I'm saying is in this moment,
your family came to this country in part to escape that.
Yes. I mean, you know, it's U.S.-funded wars, not just in Lebanon. This is the interesting thing is here in southeastern Michigan, it's U.S.-funded wars in Iraq, in Yemen, in the surrounding region, funding and sustaining the illegal occupation of Palestine. You know, these are the scars that we wear in our bodies. And so when something like October happens, it's not something that's happening very far away. We're not sleeping at night. After October 7th happened, and, you know, for me, it's not like I'm experienced that as, oh, that's a foreign policy issue. I'm in the buildings that are being bombed every night when I go to sleep when something like this happens. Mm-hmm. And so when we are urging President Biden to stop this, I'm asking the child inside of me, what do you most need? And what that child needs is the same thing that we're hearing from the children of Gaza. We need a ceasefire. We need you to stop the killing. But I also am someone who has the experience of serving our country in the United States Congress. I was in the Capitol on January 6th. Mm-hmm. If there is a group of people in this country who most knows and appreciates how dangerous Donald Trump and his white supremacist buddies are and how far away they need to stay from our White House, I'm one of those people. And so what I know, because I have the lived experience of surviving war and being a Michigander, and because I was in the Capitol on January 6th, I know that President Biden has lost people here, a state where he needs every vote he can get. And I know that he's putting our country at risk by potentially handing the presidency to President Trump unless he changes his policies. I'm hoping he changes course very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Abed Hamoud, I want to bring you into the conversation here. You've been organizing in the Arab American community, trying to organize the Arab American vote for a long time. You founded the Arab American Political Action Committee in 1998, is that right?
Yes.
So talk about this moment and how it is different, perhaps, than what you were responding to when you started doing this that long ago.
Very interesting question. Of course, over the years, we have seen many issues, and we had our ups and downs with the government or the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And personally, I have to preface this by saying two things. First, my background is mostly public service. Mm-hmm. I worked as a prosecutor for a long time. So I served my country here and abroad. And secondly is that I was a delegate for Al Gore in 2000 at Los Angeles Convention. So I'm a Democrat. It's my DNA is Democrat. So that's preface what I'm about to tell you here. This is very different, and I think the Democratic Party is missing it. And even my longtime friend, Debbie Dingell, Congressman Dingell, who was speaking here before, and we go way back for 30 years probably, I think they still think, the Democratic Party still believes that they come back to us as a community and talk politics, so to speak, talk about things we can do here, talk about how bad Donald Trump is, and then people are back into the fold. Hmm. It's not going to happen this time. I am within the community. I have been doing a lot less politics than I used to, but the Gaza war brought me back into wanting to do whatever I could do. And the depth of the anger at President Biden and the Democrats in general, because you're more angry. We have an Arabic saying that says you're more angry based on how much you love somebody. When somebody you think is close to you, is your friend, and they betray you, you're way, way more angry at them. And we're not just angry at the Democrats or surprised and shocked by them because they were our friends and we were, you know, their voters essentially, especially in recent years, but also because the Democratic values, the Democratic Party values, now you're talking about a human crisis. And people are thinking that this is just about the war and the killing. You should hear the news from this morning. The Israelis are bombing food convoys. The purpose is not just to vindicate what happened on October 7 by Israel. And it's not just to eradicate Hamas, as they claim, which they know is an impossible goal. Their purpose is really to kick the people out of Gaza and empty it and obliterate the Palestinian cause, and that the Palestinians will go live in other Arab countries, and we're done with it. They want to do to the Palestinians what was done to the Native Americans in this country. And it's not going to work. So what the Democratic Party believes, they can come back and remind us how bad Donald Trump. Donald Trump hasn't participated in the killing of our people. That's the problem.
So when you say that, I think it raises the question, and I'm going to put this to both of you. What is it that you seek by voting uncommitted? So if you don't think the Democratic Party can fix this, what is it that you hope will happen as a result of voting uncommitted on Tuesday in the primary?
See, I'm going to try to be short in my answer, but the problem is people put all the analysts and the people who are watching put the 100,000 uncommitted votes in one pot. They are not.
They are not. That's right. There's a lot of reasons that Democrats
exactly.
are concerned with the
You
pressure.
Got it. And then the reasons, and part of a big chunk of those voters, especially Arab and Muslim Americans, are not voting uncommitted as a form of temporary protest and expecting some things to be changed to come back. There are a lot of Democrats in the community who voted uncommitted because they want to stay within the fold of the Democratic Party. They want to be able to discuss with the administration the day after what we can do and then discuss things, what can be done, like you said. But there's a big chunk of the community, in my opinion, my humble opinion, I don't have a poll, It's the overwhelming majority of the people on the ground, not the leaders who are speaking with the administration, who are much more pragmatic and want to accomplish things for the community, of course. But the people on the ground, they vote uncommitted this time because they were told this is the only way you vote against Biden, is vote uncommitted. These people are going to vote against Biden in November, no matter what happens. So the question is, what's the percentage between those who will come back? But I can tell you, if there's a hope for the Democratic Party, not just Biden, because people are not thinking, for example, Alyssa Slotkin's race. She could lose it if the Republicans field a good candidate. She will lose it. So the Democratic Party has one hope, is to first call for an immediate and lasting ceasefire. This joke about temporary ceasefire during Ramadan, it's a joke. They should call for a serious one, and then they can start a serious conversation with the community and hope to salvage something.
Abbas, what's your answer to that question about the purpose here and what you hope this appeal to people to vote uncommitted might achieve? What can the president do to answer that call?
Yeah. You know, I think in this moment, a moment that is a difficult one, a moment of genocide, a moment where Palestinian people are being killed by the thousands, a moment where our own government is sending, according to the New York Times, more than 5,000, 2,000-pound bombs that are intended to completely destroy communities. What we witnessed on Tuesday is the result of a very successful targeted campaign that demonstrated that here in Michigan, if you make the case to our fellow voters, and we did this in 3 weeks, the Listen to Michigan campaign from start to end was 3 weeks.
It
was pretty quick. We made over 1 million voter contacts, and we were clear with everyone. We claimed that uncommitted box. It was, yes, a vote of protest, but there is dignity in protest. There is honor in protest. And we were on every news channel from the national to the local telling people that if you are anti-war, if you want the president to implement or to come out publicly for a ceasefire, if you want him to stop funding the killing, then you vote uncommitted. I would argue that most voters, the vast majority of the over 100,000 who voted uncommitted, knew that this was an explicitly pro-Palestinian vote, knew that this was a vote that was for peace and against war. I think that's a giant success for us as regular everyday people, especially because on the other side, there are pro-war people who are actually profiting off of every additional bomb that's dropped. So when we come together as Michiganders and say, hey, we need a different politics, I think that's really powerful. I think our pro-peace movement is growing.
So I want to pause here and just give you a bit of credit. I have watched as this whole thing kind of unfolded with a bit of envy, I think, about how effectively this unfolded. As you say, this started pretty close to Election Day. Mm-hmm. That was my first kind of worry. I was like, this seems like a rush to get this done. But then I watched as you really strategically just kept pushing the same message in different places, making contacts with people in different places. And then on Election Day, you got it done. As an African American, another constituency of the Democratic Party that I think has real grievances with leaders about all kinds of things, I was a little jealous. I was like, how come we have not been able to figure out exactly how to do that for some of our issues? So I want to give you credit for that. But I also want to ask then again, what is the goal? What's the goal of this? I mean, it's a great strategy, and there's no question you have the president's attention and the party's attention. What do you do with that attention?
Yeah, I mean, so we never set out to, you know, it's not like we were sitting around, you know, weeks and weeks ago thinking, oh, what are we going to do about the Democratic presidential primary election? No, we have an anti-war movement in our country that is multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-generational, that is a diverse coalition of people that's been trying to do everything we can to secure an immediate ceasefire that saves that next child's life. And so we've been protesting, we've been calling the White House, we've been writing to our representatives, and it has felt like they're not hearing us. You know, I was in that meeting with senior Biden officials who came to Michigan. I sat down and I looked every one of them in the eye, and I urged them, and I begged of them, and I said, "Have you advised the president to call for an immediate permanent ceasefire? Have you advised the president to call for an immediate permanent ceasefire?" None of them could give me an answer.
What
they did admit in those meetings is, the president has made missteps. That's what they said. They said he hasn't been messaging in a way that comports with his own values of valuing Palestinian lives. The reality is that meeting was over 120 days since the start of the mass killing of people. It was already too late. So what we need, to come back to your question, Stephen, we've been extremely clear. One, the president has to call publicly for a permanent ceasefire. Two, he's got to stop funding Netanyahu's war crimes, the Israeli military's war crimes. We think those are very clear demands, and we think that this is, quite frankly, a favor to the people around President Biden, that we're telling them exactly what they need to do to restart a conversation.
And so have you heard anything from the Biden campaign since Tuesday? And is it evident that they are paying attention?
There's no question to me that they're paying attention. Let's be clear. The word ceasefire was demeaned so heavily by this White House that when members of Congress started calling for one, the White House called them quote-unquote repugnant. So the day before the Democratic presidential primary election here in Michigan, President Biden, while eating an ice cream cone, is asked.
We've all seen the video.
Is asked, and he says the word ceasefire.
He does.
What we need to see, though, is we need to see you get serious about a ceasefire, Mr. President. We need to see you not say, oh, my national security advisor said, while eating an ice cream cone. We need you to put the ice cream cone down. We need you to talk to the American people and speak to the pain that Palestinian Americans in this country who are losing tens of family members, 100-plus family members in Gaza, speak to their pain. You ran as someone who is empathetic, Mr. President. He ran as someone who talked to us about his own pain. He hasn't demonstrated that empathy with Palestinian Americans who are in a deeply traumatic state right now. They are being traumatized by our own president. He needs to take a different approach.
Yeah. Abed Hamoud, before we get to a break, would that be enough? What Abbas is talking about here, if Biden does those things, if the White House changes course, do you think that would be enough for people to say, okay, I can vote for them?
That could be a start, but one number, the numbers we're not talking about, we're focusing a lot on uncommitted for good reasons, but there's a huge number of voters in Michigan in an Arab community who either stayed at home because of disgust or went to a Republican party. What we didn't look at, nobody discussed much in the discussion uncommitted, is the number of votes a former President Donald Trump got versus the votes of all the Democrats in there. He got almost, Donald Trump alone, almost topped by 10,000 votes difference, topped the Democrats, Biden, the other two Democrats, and the uncommitted combined. Mm. And then if you add the votes Nikki Haley got, now you have 300,000 votes more for the Republicans. This was not the case the last presidential primary.
That's right.
And you have to realize, I'm sure you realize, but people have to realize that this was a dead campaign on the Republican side and very lively campaign that you've been talking about on the Democratic side. So Democrats were lively and they're working on their campaign and they still got 300,000 less people to vote on their side. This is the other issue. So that's why I think the problem is much bigger than the Biden campaign and the Biden administration realizes, and it's not going to be about messaging, because I've heard talk about messaging, about talking. You got to do things on the ground. The ceasefire, the stopping the aid, they have to address it seriously. This is not going to be solved politically. It's going to have to be action.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we need to take another quick break, and when we come back, we will continue this conversation with Abbas Alawiya and Abed Hamoud about the uncommitted vote in Tuesday's presidential primary here in Michigan. We're going to get to you, the listeners, as well. Lots of folks queued up to talk about this on the phones. If you want to join them, 313-577-1019 is the number. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and at WDET and be part of the program that way. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Listening to Created Equal from 101.9 WDET in Detroit. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you are with us. We're talking about the presidential primary here in the state of Michigan, which happened earlier this week. As usual, Michigan made news in the presidential primary. It seems like we are frequently doing something that surprises people. This year, it was the number of uncommitted votes on the Democratic side. More than 100,000 people, rather than vote for Joe Biden, the president of the United States, to be renominated as the Democratic nominee, chose to vote uncommitted. One of the issues motivating those votes was the administration's position on the Israeli war in Gaza. We're talking with two members of the Arab American community here in Southeast Michigan about that vote and the organization that led to that vote. Abbas Alawiya is the spokesperson for the Listen to Michigan campaign. He's also a former chief of staff for Missouri Congressperson Cori Bush and was the legislative director for Rashida Tlaib here in Michigan. Also with us is Abed Hamoud. He is the founder of the Arab American Political Action Committee. We want to hear from you, our listeners, about what you did on Tuesday. Did you vote uncommitted? Did you vote for Joe Biden? What are you thinking about as we get deeper into 2024, into the presidential elections, and of course toward November, when we will all have a chance to select the next president. Are these issues guiding some of your thoughts? Are they giving you pause about supporting President Joe Biden? 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and at WDET, and we can include you that way. Let's start today with Frank in Detroit. Frank, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Hi.
Stephen, can you hear me?
I sure can.
So I want to thank you for your program. I want to thank you for taking callers. Very important. I want to give a shout out to Gabriela Santiago Romero, to Rashida Tlaib, and to my union president, Sean Fain, all of whom have supported the ceasefire resolutions.
Yes.
So it's broader than the Arab community. I want to thank your two spokespersons who have been articulating the message extremely well. I am a family of persons who died in the Nazi Holocaust, and very much identify with the concerns of the genocide that's currently taking place in Gaza. We organized an event in Dearborn the 2 days before the vote, and the spirit and the power of people at that event were just staggering. And it went beyond just the Arab community. I think the issue here is two things. One, the elephant in the room is the Israeli lobby, which has been described as the most powerful lobby, more than the oil industry, more than any other industry in influencing U.S. politics. And therefore, what we're talking about is a lack of democracy. The Biden administration is not reflecting the democratic will of the people. Mm. It's known that a majority of people in the U.S. are opposed to what's our role in supporting.
Frank, I want to, before I have to let you go, I want to ask you more about your own history and how that motivates the way you're thinking about what's happening in Gaza. Now, I think that's a really important parallel. Can you talk about that?
The parallel, I'm sorry?
The parallel between your own history and what's happening in Gaza.
Yeah, thank you. So my family was not of the Jewish faith, but my family was described as a Jewish race.
Hmm.
And because we were described as a Jewish race by Hitler and by the Nazis in Germany, my parents fled Germany in the early 30s. They recognized the danger. And it didn't matter whether we were of a religious persuasion, Jewish or otherwise. It was known in our family trajectory and history and family tree that we were of a Jewish, quote-unquote, race. And we see the same thing here in that there is a built-in a racism.
Yeah.
Directed at the Palestinian people who at one time lived side by side peacefully with Jewish folks going back to a century ago.
Yeah. Frank, that's such an important point, and I'm glad. I think you made it really eloquently. I think all of us who are thinking about what's going on in Gaza need to put it into that kind of context. Think of the times in our own lives when we have been singled out and devalued, right? Told that our lives either have no value at all or don't have as much value as someone else's. That history for you, Frank, is important in thinking about what's going on in the Middle East right now. Let's go next to Richard in Detroit. Richard, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
There are a couple of things I wanted to say and point out. I agree that there needs to be a permanent ceasefire. I think that Israel has crossed over from defending itself to oppression. With that being said, I sympathize with the Arab community in this plight. But the one thing I'm not hearing is the condemnation of Hamas and the call for them to stop their acts and brutality. And I think that that needs to be a discussion also. And it does need to be a two-state solution. I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, Richard, really appreciate the call. Abbas and Abed, I'll give you a chance to answer Richard's call here.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of why we're pushing for an immediate permanent ceasefire is because it is the quickest way possible to stop the killing, to secure everyone's life, to ensure that hostages come back and prisoners come back. But we also have to recognize that what we're dealing with is not a situation that's happening in a vacuum. And what we're dealing with is our government is heavily funding the oppression on one side. Our government does not give money to Hamas. Our government gives money to the tune of billions and billions of dollars to the Israeli military to sustain an illegal military occupation and right now to carry out a genocide. That is horrific. If our government were giving money to Hamas, you can count me as the first person who would say, stop giving money to Hamas. Thankfully, our government doesn't. But shamefully, our government gives billions of dollars to the Israeli military to carry out war crimes. And that's awful.
Do you worry, as I think many Israelis do, that if there is a ceasefire, that Hamas wouldn't recognize that ceasefire and might go back to doing what it was doing on October 7th or do something else?
I think the temporary ceasefire that happened previously demonstrates that a deal can be reached. But more than anything, I would say, I worry that the Israeli military will continue sustaining an illegal military occupation that further dispossesses Palestinian people. I worry that the Israeli government will continue implementing what has been described by human rights organization after human rights organization as an apartheid system that relegates Palestinians as second class citizens over and over. I think that the idea of like, oh, but what if Hamas doesn't follow it? Let's be clear of who we can hold responsible here, who we have more leverage over. And that is an Israeli military that is carrying out war crimes using our tax dollars. I think we should divest from that.
Abed, what do we do about?
I'm a peaceful person and I don't believe in solving any conflicts by killing. And I don't believe in indiscriminate killing of civilians. But let's start from the root cause, from the beginning. Start condemning everybody who's been killing civilians indiscriminately. And that starts in 1948, from the days the Israeli, you know, the Israel as was founded, and they started killing Arabs indiscriminately. And I can spend 3 hours on a show like yours summarizing, not detailing, the number of massacres committed by the Israelis. I witnessed personally some of them. I grew up in South Lebanon, in an era that preceded Hamas and Hezbollah. It preceded all of those. And I was under the Israeli bombs all the times. I was scared from the Israelis many times when they bombed my village and we didn't have shelters. So all I had to do was at 12 years old, I remember clearly in 1978, we were huddling in a corner. My mom thought behind the fridge was a safe place. I don't know why. There's six of us. I'm the oldest of six brothers and sisters. And then every time the plane comes over our heads and roars. The roar of the plane is something you never forget.
Sure,
but we can talk about the condemning here, but let's start condemning from the beginning.
But I think the specific question is about Hamas and other terrorist groups, whether a ceasefire, whether a two-state solution solves that problem.
A permanent solution that gives the Palestinians their state and their dignity. It's very important. People without dignity, and we know this in the U.S., and we talked about other groups, including African Americans. Mm-hmm. When people live without their dignity, they're going to be scared even of the police officers who come to their homes. I worked as a prosecutor. I worked with communities in Detroit. I know how it is. Until you start treating people with respect, give them their rights, their independence, their dignity, they're going to be people who are going to uprise and say, whether they use a knife, whatever they use, and I'm not encouraging or condemning anybody killing any civilian on any side, but the problem has to be resolved. Hamas is one symptom, one reaction to a problem, and there have been many reactions over the years. Yeah. So even if Hamas is gone today, even if, and I don't think it will be with the war that's going on now, because the nature of it, there will be other movements as long as the Palestinians don't have an independent state that they live in dignity in it.
I say a lot to friends who don't come from the community that I do that I don't think you have the right to say to somebody else how they procure or defend their freedom, how they defend their human dignity. And if you are part of a system that has its foot on someone else's neck, I'm not sure that you get to decide how they get that foot off there.
South Africa apartheid. We've seen this before. We see how it ended.
And I would just add to Stephen, we can be clear about how not to do something. The way to address the problem, you know, any problems in Gaza is not through collective punishment, is not through the killing of 12,000 children and 30,000 innocent Palestinians.
Okay, we are out of time, but Abed and Abbas, it was really great to have both of you here to guide us through this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
That's going to do it for us here on Created Equal. We will be back tomorrow with more programming. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's public radio station, your connection to news, music, and conversation.